Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I am your host, Mona Shank. You guys, we are doing an earlier podcast because my guest today is a busy man, and rightfully so, because he is very talented, he's hilarious, and it's always a pleasure running into him. You've seen him on Netflix, and I was just looking at the amount of mixes of ethnicities he has. He is Lebanese, Palestinian, Italian, if I'm not mistaken, but he's actually listed as Lebanese-American, and the New York Times describes him as, it describes his comedy as an analytic style full of wordplay, clever misdirection, and ethnic humor riffing on his Middle Eastern roots. Here is my very funny and talented friend, Samuel Bade. How are you?
Hey, how you doing?
All right, man, you know, hanging in there, doing the best we can. How has the pandemic been for you?
Well, it was, last year really sucked, but this year's been all right.
Yeah, yeah. Is stuff like, are you getting booked on shows and stuff picking up for you?
Yeah, people are asking me to do shows. I'm just hesitant. I'm hesitant to go out. I don't want to like hit the road just yet. So I'm doing like all local stuff right now. But yeah, people are hitting me up. So it's cool.
Hesitant meaning like, have you not been vaccinated? Is that what the hesitation is?
I haven't been vaccinated. I got COVID about a month ago. So I don't want to get vaccinated just yet. But I got COVID from doing a show. So you can get it at shows. But yeah, I was going to get vaccinated this month, but I'm going to wait now because I still got the antibodies.
That's right. How sick were you when you got, you know, from COVID?
It wasn't bad. It was like a mild flu. I had these like body aches that were like pretty intense, but other than that, it was pretty mild.
Wow. That just means you have a good body composition. That's what that means.
I got good genes, you know.
That's good genes, baby. My brother, so I went and got the, Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah.
My brother got it and it put him out of commission for like 3 days. And I was like, wait, we have the exact same genes. I don't understand why you're so out of commission. But it's interesting how the vaccines are revealing people's body compositions of how different bodies are, you know, intake.
Blood type, you know, your biomarkers, like how in shape you are. How old's your brother, if you don't mind me asking?
My brother is like 44, 45 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's weird. Like once you get to like the 30s, 40s, it could go either way. You know, like 20s, you're most likely fine. But like 30s or 40s, like it just depends on some shit.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Sammy, no, I was, man, I always thought that you were of, you know, you were a mix of Lebanese and Palestinian, but you also have Italian blood in you. So what is that whole mix that you have going on?
The Italian, it's just one eighth Italian. It's a little sliver of pizza.
Okay, got it. Got it. So a sliver of pizza.
Yeah.
So who's Palestinian and who's Lebanese?
So both my parents are half Lebanese.
Okay.
And my dad is Palestinian. And then my mom is where the Euro-Italian comes from.
Wow, got it. Sammy, I know that you made a post. I was looking at your Twitter 7 hours ago. You posted that, you know, you got a lot of backlash about that Jesus was a Palestinian. And then you were like, fuck you guys. Here's another video.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so ridiculous. It's
true. I mean, historically, you're absolutely correct. Jesus was a Palestinian.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways of interpreting it. So first of all, if you look at the current borders, Bethlehem is in Palestine. So the joke plays out in that sense. But if that's not good enough for you, fine. You want to go back to the history, you can say, well, he was born in the province of Judea. Well, that was a Roman Empire. Okay, well, he was born in the Kingdom of Israel. Sure, yes, the term Israel existed back then, and so did the term Palestine. So Palestine, to say you're Palestinian, you say Philistini.
That's right.
Right. So like the etymology of Palestinian goes, I'm not going to say that it goes back as far as Israel, because who knows? It could be Israel could have been like 100, 1,000 years earlier. But it's like people always say, oh, Palestinians made up. It didn't exist till 1921. Like that's complete bullshit. Like Philistini, right. Palestine, the etymology goes back to close around the time when the etymology of Israel came out.
Right. Right. So you got banned on TikTok, or they removed your posts about this? What happened?
Yeah, well, I got banned on TikTok. A bunch of posts got flagged like one after the next. and the flags were from videos about Israel-Palestine, and like you could tell people were commenting and they were angry. And then the next thing you know, like one of the, they flagged the video, and then I reposted it. And so the first one got flagged for hate speech, absolutely no hate speech in it. And I reposted it like kind of coy, like, hey guys, TikTok took this down for hate speech. Can you tell me where you see the hate speech?
Yeah.
And then immediately I post it and it starts going viral again. And people are just saying no hate speech, no hate speech. Yeah. There's nothing here. There's nothing here. And then by the end of the day, it was flagged again.
Huh? Sorry, what were you talking about in the video that people...
That particular video was a... Because, you know, TikTok are minute-long videos. So there was a sketch, a three-minute sketch that I made with my former roommate, Toby, who's Jewish. And the sketch is called I'm Palestinian, My Roommate is Jewish. And it's basically just kind of a satire of the Palestinian-Israeli situation.
Yeah.
And it was part of the sketch where Toby puts up a divider saying... I just wanted to find where your part of the apartment ends and mine begins.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, where's my care package? My mom sent me a care package. He's like, he said there might have been weapons inside. We had to intercept it. And then I take a banana and I'm like, well, this innocent banana is going to die. And then I slit the banana's throat. Oh, so, and the thing is, you know, that was the most risque part of it. But you know, the people who flagged it they didn't have the issue with that part.
Right. So their issue is with what? That you're making a joke about the divider,
the interception of goods coming in, like the blockade of Gaza, basically. But so here's the one thing that I did, because I posted this video. This is an old video. I reposted it on TikTok, chopped up.
Well, I remember you doing this joke. That's the one joke about I really remember, along with other awesome math jokes that you do. But that's the one joke I remember. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was a joke that I used to tell. We turned it into a sketch, posted it a long time ago, and then posted it on TikTok because it was relevant. And we changed the title for this specific video to I'm Palestinian, My Roommate is Israeli, instead of Jewish, because it's not fair to say Jewish at that point in the analogy, because now we're talking about an empire versus the Jewish people. And so I made that choice when I thought it was like a diplomatic choice to make. And that's what ticked people off. And the reason is, I think all this happened is because I posted a video about anti-Semitism about a year ago, you know, obviously denouncing it and saying that, you know, like telling a personal story where there was like this old joke I used to tell about my Jewish friend. And I told him America's Got Talent. And that video went viral, got like 2 million views.
Yeah.
And I think I got a lot of fans from Israel. And turns out, later down the line, when they saw kind of like where I stood on Palestinian issues, I think that's where they drew the line and they started to flag me.
You know, my fan James here says, I wouldn't be surprised if organized pro-Israel groups were monitoring social media to wipe out any mention of Palestine. I mean, that's. Have you noticed this with other people?
It's a thing that's happening, but I'm not gonna go ahead and say that there's a conspiracy that's happening, because first of all, I don't think it's systemic in the sense that like I don't think a government entity is or like even a lobby is like actually controlling the situation.
Yeah.
But I do think the people who are offended about it tend to be people who are very coordinated with each other. Like they have Facebook groups where if they don't like something, they'll flag it. I mean, this is something that I've heard from a lot of people.
Right.
And, it's not conspiratorial in the sense that these people just work together well. That's
right.
All.
Right. Now, Sammy, I know we kind of deep dived into your TikTok banning and the Palestinian thing. But I wanted to actually ask you, you're born and raised in Northern California. Am I understanding this correctly or no?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Oakland, born in Oakland, California, raised in Berkeley, California, Fremont, California, which is in the East Bay area. Yeah.
And are you an only child? Do you have siblings?
No, I have an older sister. Yeah.
And is she a scientist or something brilliant?
No. She's a yoga instructor.
Are you blowing my life?
No.
She's a yoga instructor.
Yeah.
How cool. And she's also in Oakland or that around?
She's in the Bay Area, yeah.
She's in the Bay Area. I mean, Sammy, what is it? I mean, Bay Area is pretty, I mean, I think now it's pretty liberal, but what was it like when you were growing up there? Was it liberal? What were you guys one of the only Middle Eastern families that were around growing up? Like, what was that like?
Well, when we moved, well, the thing is, growing up in Berkeley, like, I noticed right away it was diverse. I wasn't able to, like, decipher what race was. But by the time we got to Fremont, Fremont was kind of a wider city. And now Fremont's completely transformed. You have one of the biggest Afghani populations, you know, outside of Afghanistan. You have a lot of Asian people, a lot of Indian people, you know, handful of Middle Eastern people, a lot, you know, handful of Black Latino people. So you have a pretty good mix now. But when I was growing up here, it was pretty white.
Wow. I mean, Sammy, like, you, did you not go, you went to Berkeley, didn't you?
I did. I went to Berkeley, yeah.
And did you graduate or just kind of middle way through? You're like, I'm not doing this.
Well, no, I thought about that, but I graduated. Yeah.
You did. What did you graduate with?
I had two degrees. One was in business and one was in applied mathematics.
And then you were like, I'm going to apply these degrees to comedy.
Well, it was more like, I don't want to do any of the shit that you're supposed to do with these degrees. So I'm going to see what else there is. And then I tried comedy and went well. So I just kept doing it.
Did you have like a, did you have this, you know, a lot of South Asian, Middle Eastern kids had that, you know, you have to go to college. You have to get an degree. Once you get it, then you can do whatever you want. Right. Did you get those degrees because your parents were expecting that of you, or you did it because you thought it'll be fun doing them?
No, it was more because my parents, but it wasn't like the expectation was really weak. Like, it wasn't like your kind of typical brown family. It was honestly, when I was in high school, I was kind of like getting disillusioned. I started smoking pot and I was like kind of going off into this direction where I didn't want to do well in school anymore. And I was like thinking about dropping out as soon as I could. Yeah. And I remember my sister told me, she's like, you know, mom and dad, just, they want you to go to college. Yeah. They never even said it to me. They never even said, you got to go to college. This is what you do. My sister was like, you know, that's what they want. Uh-huh. So like, oh, okay. So I guess I'm just going to do this because that's what they want. But yeah. It was more like, it wasn't like, oh, they're making me do this. It was more like, I'm going to just do this. You know, I like being educated. I like education.
Yeah.
You know, I like learning. So I was just like, you know, it's a win-win. But once I get the degree, I'm not guaranteeing anything.
Right. Right. I mean, Sammy, did you grow up like, were your parents always like very loving, supportive? Hey, mm-hmm. come talk to us.
Yeah.
Parents, or was there like this level of like detachment or?
That's a good question. I mean, it was really a combo of both because they were completely supportive, like very open-minded, kind of let me do whatever I want.
Yeah.
Very cool, very easygoing people and taught me a lot, you know, gave me a good sense of morality. But at the same time, they weren't super like, oh, you can tell us anything. It wasn't that kind of relationship. I mean, I don't think that's a normal thing to have amongst parents, but it wasn't like like my grandma told me, like, for instance, I didn't learn how to tie my shoe until I was like 9. So like, there's a lot of things they didn't teach me. And like my grandma will say like, oh, they didn't teach you manners. They just kind of threw you to the wolves. But like, I felt like they taught me morality and they were very open-minded and like kept me like spiritually grounded. But in every other way, it was more just kind of like, all right, you know,
yeah,
you have kids and
which sounds pretty kind of standard, you know, Middle Eastern, South Asian household where we don't talk about feelings, we don't really talk about
emotion, we don't
talk about that stuff,
very much,
right. Yeah, where it's like, oh, I have a roof over your head, I fed you, you're fine, you're safe, you're not physically harmed,
right.
Good enough.
You're fine. Exactly.
You know, I mean, what about your sister? Were you very close to your sister growing up? Did you guys like would sit down and conspire about stuff like, I can't believe mom said that or dad?
Yeah. I mean, just by the nature of, you know, being only two siblings, but we also fought a lot. So,
yeah,
it was kind of back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you very protective of your sister growing up, or were you like, whatever?
No, whatever. Because to be honest, like, she was pretty abusive.
Verbally, emotionally, physically, all of the above? What are we talking about?
All of the above. So, like, honestly, like, by the time, like, I saw her more as, like, the oppressor. So, like, by the time, you know, we were in high school, it wasn't like, oh, I got to protect my sister. It was like, you know, I got to, you know, watch out for my sister.
What's your age gap with your sister?
Just 3 years.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. I always thought like older sisters are very like protective of their younger siblings, but
yeah.
You know, maybe
It was, I mean, it definitely felt a little bit that way, but it was like protective and in an abusive way also.
Maybe she didn't quite get the memo on that one.
Yeah. It's fine.
You protect if you beat your sibling up.
That's
how you roll. So, I mean, do you feel like, you know, I like to ask a lot of my comic friends that I bring on here about comedy. I feel, okay, so this is kind of my take on stand-up. Mm-hmm. I feel like when you look at the greats, right, like your Richard Pryor, your Carlins, you know, I feel like they all come from a background of trauma and, like, fucked upness, right? I mean, for God's sake, Richard Pryor grew up in a brothel, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, right.
You know, I feel like somebody was asking me the other day, I was being interviewed, and they're like, what would you say to younger comics about doing comedy? And I was like, if you come from a nice, loving, stable household, don't fucking do comedy. Like, why are you going to do that? I mean, it's a hard fucking life. Like, why would you? You only do it because you need it. You don't do it because you want it. So right. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I would be lying if I told you I haven't had that thought where, like, you know, I meet someone, I'm like, yeah, I want to do comedy. I'm like, you look like you've had no adversity in your life, precisely. You know? But at the same time, you know, like, I can't really complain too much about my upbringing. You know, I just had your normal flavors of melancholy and depression that any human being has.
Yeah.
So really you realize at some point the human experience is all suffering. Like, we've all suffered to some extent where some of us have a more robust suffering story and some of us just kind of had a normal story, you know?
Right. But do you, like, your comedy, I feel, is very, it's very smart. It's also very cerebral. That's what I mm-hmm. feel like when mm-hmm. I watch your comedy, right? Mm-hmm. It's very well thought out. You know, you got your math jokes and you got your history jokes, and they're brilliant. You know, I feel like, you know, do you feel that they're, I don't know, do you feel like, oh, because you didn't have trauma in your life that it could be something more than what you do, or you don't feel that way at all?
Sorry, can you repeat that question? I'm trying to
process. Yeah, I'm talking about, like, you know, sometimes, like, I watch comics and, you know, they, like, for instance, like Hannah Gadsby, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you watched Nanette.
Yeah, it's not special. Yeah.
I watched Nanette and it, like, it fucked me up. It was brilliant and it, like, messed me up. Like, the last half hour, it just messed me up. And I was watching that and it really gave me the courage to write my shit, because I've been through so much trauma, but I've just never had the courage to get up there and talk about it because I've just had so much shame attached to it, so much pain attached to it. I just didn't know how to verbalize it. So I think, but I feel like, you know, when I sometimes watch Middle Eastern and South Asian comics, I feel like a lot of us come from that lovely, stable kind of loving parent background. But I almost feel like there's a lot of pain or trauma that's missing because it's a lot more cerebral than it is emotional.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, and I've been told many times, it's like, oh, you know, if you were, like, more emotional on stage, I think you could connect to people more. And I'm just like, well, I'm just being myself, you know, like, I'm not going to, like, fake being emotional just to, like, get extra connection from the audience.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, cerebral conveying thought is another form of conveying human experience. It's just like, it's just a different level of wavelength of communicating, you know? And pain can be felt cerebrally, you know? You don't have to feel it in your heart.
You don't have to feel it in your body. You can just feel it in your head and just let it
pass. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I can understand. I can see that. And I can definitely understand that for sure. So, I mean, you know, I watched your show you did on Netflix. It was about 100. It's called 100 Questions. Did I?
100 Humans.
100 Humans. Mm-hmm. And I watched it, and I liked it a lot. I thought it was great. You had this other show on Netflix called So Happy Hour. Is that it?
It's not on Netflix. That's my own. That's my own show.
That's your own show. And what is the show about?
It's just like a talk show. I'll have a guest, and I'll have a musical guest, and then I'll do some jokes and sketches.
Yeah. And this is a what, on YouTube? What is it on?
You can see it on YouTube. We do it live pretty much every week.
Yeah, that's all. That's awesome. So, I mean, do you ever get confused for Hasan Minhaj?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Because I Googled you looking for your picture, and said Hasan Minhaj, I'm like, that's Sami Obaid. That is not Hasan Minhaj.
Yeah, yeah.
Not all brown people look the same. What the hell?
Right. Yeah, you know, so like I met Hasan when I was maybe less than a year into comedy, and I had really long hair. And we hung out all the time. We did comedy together for a long time, and nobody ever mixed us up. Huh. And then about 2 years into comedy, I cut my hair because like a lot of my act kind of like depended on it. I had this joke about looking like Jesus, and I would like talk about my curls, and like people would just like, it was part of the act, and I didn't want my act to depend on the hair anymore. So I cut the hair.
Okay.
And as soon as I cut the hair, people started like mistaking me for Hasan. And that never stopped. It just kept going until the pandemic happened and my hair just grew back. And now nobody does it anymore.
No, nobody's done. Well, I know Hasan's show ended also, right? Patriot Act?
Did it end? Yeah.
Yeah, it ended. So, I mean, do you, you know, when you watch, you know, there's a big wave happening, right? Mm-hmm. Of South Asian comics and Middle Eastern comics, like that. There's a big wave happening. Do you feel like, when we go up there, whether it be, you know, you or whether it be me, that there are certain expectations of us, of what we can or cannot talk about on stage versus a straight white person, whether it be male or female?
Yeah, I mean, there's things that you can't get away with saying, and there's things you can get away with saying, you know?
Yeah.
I think everybody has their advantages, and you learn to sneak in the words that you're allowed to.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of stuff you think we can't get away with?
So, you know, if you go to the middle of the country where you have not necessarily a typical American crowd, but like, let's say you have a lot of like Republicans or kind of like far right people who just aren't into immigrants or just aren't into that perspective, or like they'll be friendly if you're there, but they don't really, they're not going to like laugh if you talk about, you know, the Palestinian strife. You know, so those kinds of people are going to instantly feel more comfortable when they see a white person on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, listen, I mean, maybe I would get pushback for saying this, but like I've seen it in audience. There's people who get more comfortable when I'm on stage versus a white person. Like every crowd is different. Every crowd has its own mind.
Yeah.
I've gone to a lot of shows in the middle of the country where I step on stage and I can feel they're uncomfortable because they think I'm about to say some shit that's not going to relate to them. And fortunately, I've written enough jokes where I have stuff they can relate to them, but like it doesn't, I have to not be completely myself. And maybe that's just because I'm not fully evolved as a comedian. And that is absolutely part of it. But it's also because a lot of people are just fucking racist.
Right. Right. I mean, what has been your like experience where you did something, you know, middle of the country, conservative, you know, Republicans? I did a show in Nevada about 2 years ago, and this is a veterans show on a Sunday afternoon. Everyone is 50 plus and they're all white. It's as white as they come, Sammy. Okay. And I'm like, oh my god, Mona, this is either gonna go really good or really bad. So I'm like, all right, no political jokes, so that's out, so we're just gonna stick with upbringing, family, that's it. And just observational. That's it. That's all we're going to stick with. I get up. I start doing my set. I start, you know, applauding because it's veterans. I'm like, thank you very much for your service. And these two white dudes in the middle of the fucking room start yelling at me. And they're like, liar. They're like, you don't give a shit about this country. I'm like, this motherfucker right here. Right. So I'm like, hey, I'm like, bring up the lights. You know, I'm like, bring up the lights. I was like, let me see who the fuck is talking. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you want to stand up and want to talk to me? And the guy's like, he's so quiet. I'm like, oh, you're not such a fucking hot shot now, are you? You know, I was like, who here wants these people to shut the fuck up? Everybody's like, yeah, shut the fuck up. Wait, now bring the lights down. So have you had experiences like that where people are just, it's almost like you have to prove your fucking Americanness. It's like, dude, I love this country. I'm here. I am this person because of this country. So like, do you feel that way sometimes when you do shows, or have you experienced stuff like that?
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I'm referring to. It's kind of assumed a default because you look like you're an immigrant or you look like you're a product of immigrants.
Yeah.
That you're going to say some shit, like you better watch what you say. You better fucking just be nothing but thankful and, you know, say Blue Lives Matter at the end of your set.
I'm not saying.
Right. But yeah, I've had plenty of experiences. I remember I did a show in Nevada one time. A guy comes up and after, he's like, "You're pretty funny for a towel head." Walks out. I did a show in Chicago. This was when Trump was running, and I didn't know yet that outside of like your little LA New York bubbles, that Trump jokes are going to piss a lot of people off. So like a dude just called me like an idiot in the middle of my set. And just started talking mad shit. And I didn't know why, but I found out later it's because he liked Trump. But like, it was that mentality. It was like, oh, here we go. One of these fucking, you know what I mean? Like ISIS, you know what I mean?
Right.
Listen, like.
You were making Trump jokes and then he just started heckling you. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and like I don't like to be conspiratorial because it's like everybody's different. This world is filled with like different people. I don't want to paint people with a broad brush, but like when you do comedy for long enough, I've been doing it for 15 years. If I get in front of a crowd and somebody feels weird about me, I can sense it.
That's right.
You go into a place like that where, like, for instance, it's all white people, and some of them, you know, first of all, sometimes you'll be wrong. Sometimes you'll be absolutely wrong. I remember I did a show in Nashville, Tennessee, and this like big white dude looks like, you know, straight off of a farm comes up to me. He's like, "My name's Bubba." He's like, "You were the funniest damn comedian I ever seen." He's like, I have a Lebanese friend upstate. He's good people." Like never would have thought that was going to happen. So like I get proven wrong all the time, but sometimes you can see somebody with their arms crossed. You can see the way they're looking at you. And you'd be like, you know, that person's skinned head is very shiny, you know, and you kind of know what's going on.
Yeah. Usually I get the arms folded by the Pakistani aunties. That's what I get.
To be honest, like, you know,
the mild disappointment on their face.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about white crowds and stuff, but honestly, I've bombed way harder in front of
brown crowds, right?
Yeah.
Well, why do you think that is? Sammy, do you think like, you know, culturally, I feel like, you know, it's definitely true for the Pakistani and Indian crowd, where comedy is still new to us. It's only 10 years old.
Exactly.
I mean, is that the same for you guys, for Lebanese and Palestinian, or for Middle Eastern comics?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really like Russell Peters kind of opened the door for that whole thing. Like Russell Peters made, you know, Indian people want to go to stand-ups, and he even helped out, you know, because he was very popular in the Middle East too. And
that's right.
And after Russell Peters, you had the Axis of Evil. So like Indians and Middle Easterners going to comedy shows again. I mean, it's now maybe like on average, like 15 years old, but it's still new, still very new.
Right.
And so they're not trained comedy audiences. They don't know what to do. They don't know how the beats of jokes go. You know, they're just used to like listening to old uncle jokes, you know, so they don't know. They don't know where to laugh. So, I mean, it's not their fault. It's like they're new to it, you know?
Right, right. I mean, have you ever just gotten up there and started doing jokes and everybody's just talking, or they're eating, or they're like, "Sorry, we can't be bothered by this thing you're doing on stage. Anywho," and then you're like, "Hi."
Yeah, I mean, that's happened a lot. I mean, normally if I'm doing like a bigger gig, I'll tell them not to let that kind of shit happen while I'm on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like for me, I did a show once for this very wealthy group of Pakistanis in Orange County. And I'm in the middle of doing my set, and nobody cares, because there's this very famous singer from Pakistan that has arrived, and the aunties are fucking creaming their goddamn pants, like this dude to fucking show up on stage.
Yeah.
And they're like telling me, I'm in the middle of my set, and the organizer walks up to me on stage and is like, hi, can we just have the singer go up now? I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, you know what? They're like, can you do the set after? I'm like, I can do the set after. And when I do, I'm gonna go in full roast mode. That's what the fuck's going on. So he does his thing, he leaves, and then I just don't give a fuck after. Yeah. I want to, and I just start roasting people. I'm like, fuck you too. You got your fucking, you know, I just do. I'm like, fuck you guys, don't fucking invite me. Fuck off, I don't care at this point. You know, it's like, you just get in that mode where you're like, yo, they don't fucking respect it, fuck it, you know? Have you ever got, have you ever done a set or show for a Middle Eastern crowd and then people walk up to you and they're like, I didn't know.
After, like they walk up after? I don't think I've had a lot of like walk up negative feedback from Middle Eastern crowds.
It's immediate. It's just while you're on stage.
Yeah, just while you're on stage. Exactly. I would rather they just, you know, save it for later. But I did a show in the OC once for Middle Eastern crowd, and they were serving dinner during my set. And it was just very difficult. And they had me booked for 20 minutes. But because it wasn't going well, they tried to get me off the stage at 5. And I started going into the crowd, and like I walked into the crowd like to get them to laugh because they weren't laughing. So I started going in and like talking to them, roasting them a little bit. And then the host, like, she went back on stage and she was like, all right, well, that's all. And I'm like, no, I'm still doing my set. So like, it became kind of a battle. And then I went for like another 5-10 minutes. And then finally I was just like, I'm done. And it got okay near the end, but it was just like, it was just uncomfortable for everybody. And it's because they didn't know how to have a comedy show. They didn't know how to treat comedians. They didn't know how to set it up right. So I had to do what I had to do.
Simon, do you know, one thing I've been observing about our people, and I'll just put, you know, all brown looking people like us in one umbrella. But I feel like because comedy is new to us, whether it be here or, you know, in our home countries.
Yeah.
I feel like our cultures, and I'll definitely speak for Pakistani culture, and you can tell me about Lebanese, Palestinian culture. Our people don't like criticism. Any kind of criticism, any kind of pointing out the bullshit, don't do that. Don't make fun of that. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way?
Well, I mean, I do feel that there's a lot of content restrictions when you do these kinds of brown shows. Each one is different. You know, sometimes like they're okay with sex, but you can't do politics. Like sometimes they're okay with politics, but you can't curse. Sometimes like they don't even want you to talk about dating because it's so weird. You know, like it just really depends on the crowd. But like, yeah, there's a lot of content restrictions.
Right. But I'm saying like in general, I feel like brown people don't really like to hear criticism of, you know, it's just like, we're fine. Just don't talk about us. Just talk about them white people. Talk about other ethnicities. Just don't talk about our bullshit, right?
I don't know. Yeah. I can't say I felt that way specifically, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sorry. I didn't.
I can't say that I felt that way. I mean,
you don't feel that way. Like that's
no,
not.
I haven't sensed that any more than I would with any other crowd.
Interesting.
I mean, I feel like the essence of a lot of comedy is criticism. You got to be criticizing something in front of it.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. Yeah. I don't know if you heard, but we might just dive into this for a bit. This whole thing about cancel culture, man, how are you feeling about it? I mean, do you feel like what happened to you on TikTok is part of that a little bit, or is that something different?
I think it's something different. I mean, it's definitely, you could say it's under the umbrella of larger cancel culture, but it's not, it doesn't seem related to the cancel culture that we typically talk about. You know, but the way it's the same is there exists a system which is so fragile in which a few people's voices can prevent somebody from, you know, getting the exposure on a medium despite what the masses think. That's the general broad definition of cancel culture in which it fits. However, it's not a thing where like I'm a celebrity and I said something that like pisses a lot of people off and they don't want to see me in the networks. That's different.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about, I think Seth Rogen just got a big backlash because he's like, hey, you know, at some point your jokes are not going to age well. And that's fine. Like, that's okay. That's just part of your growth. And then one stand-up comic came out on Twitter is like, can we just cancel the fact that Seth Rogen is actually considered a stand-up comic? And I was like, oh, that's a burn. That's a burn right there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is, you know, it has divided comedy into camps. Like, honestly, I don't give a shit. Like, if you want to feel like people are canceling too easily, you can. But I also see the other side of things. I see, like, dude, there is a line. You can't be molesting people.
That's right.
Like, what do you mean? Like, oh, he got canceled. What did he do? Well, he molested, like, three people. Okay, well, Right. I think that's probably a good thing, you know?
That's right.
Well, somebody got canceled. Well, they said the N-word 7 times. I mean, 7?
Right. They should have been canceled on the first one. I mean, canceled 7. Right.
Yeah. I mean, listen, with those kinds of transgressions, I get it. You know, like, I guess there's borderline stuff. Like, Aziz Ansari, he had a date where he was pretty sexually aggressive, although he did not technically assault or anything like
that's
that.
Correct. That's
you
correct.
You know what I mean?
That's correct. That was just a date gone bad.
That was a bad date where the woman had different expectations, and Aziz comes in like, I'm a star and I want to get my dick sucked.
That's right. That's
like,
correct.
That was an obvious human thing, but she was able to put it out there in a way that, you know, got a lot of people thinking and not wanting, you know.
Right.
But, you know, like that's one of those kind of like fine line cases, I think. But,
right.
You know, like with Louis, for instance, like that seems to have crossed a line, you know. But like, you cancel someone forever. I mean, like you, Louis's not canceled. He's still making a living. He's still selling out clubs. So yeah. Like, what
Sorry,
is
we talking about? Oh, Louis C.K.
Okay. Yeah. But like, yeah. So what is a cancel? You know what I mean? A cancel is only effective if enough people actually cancel you.
That's right.
You know, T.J. Miller, he raped someone in college, allegedly. I don't know if he did or not.
Yes.
But that's what they said he did. And he got canceled, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. Still selling out clubs.
Right.
So like, you know, where does it end? I mean, I got canceled on TikTok.
Right.
For being, you know, saying things against Israel's government. And I lost the, you know, that sweet monthly TikTok check. But I'm still on Instagram.
Right. Absolutely. So you put the same content on Instagram and Twitter, and nobody, you don't get canceled there. Nobody's reporting you, or they're not, you know.
I mean, I'm not gonna say who. Hallelujah, Instagram, because I've heard people getting canceled on Instagram too. So
sure. I just feel, Sammy, like I think you said it pretty accurately. It's like, look, if you are soliciting sex from underage girls, in the case of Chris D'Elia, you should be held accountable for that. You're soliciting sex, not just from one, multiple.
Yeah.
Right.
And then it goes back to the thing of, well, these are just allegations. We don't have the proof. But it's like, I don't know. Like, it seems to happen to certain people who got themselves in similar situations. And if they did it once, they likely did it twice and thrice and et cetera, et cetera. And like, you know, if you everybody has a gut instinct, and, you know, usually the gut of the people is somewhat right.
Right. And so, I mean, like, let's not forget that, you know, the only reason Bill Cosby got held accountable is because he got called out by another black male comic. But thank God for Hannibal Buress. Like, thank God for Hannibal Buress going on and saying, dude, he's been raping women since the fucking 70s. Like, how is he not held accountable? That video goes viral, and then all cases start resurfacing back up again, right?
Yeah, Hannibal Buress essentially was the igniter of the Me Too movement.
That's right. I mean, that's right.
And it wasn't like his intention, but like he had a good joke about a premise that nobody would talk about, even though it was a story. It already existed. Like, it was, you could search online and you could find it. And he was like, yo, why the fuck is nobody talking about this?
Right.
And then society realized, like, yo, like, why are we not talking about this?
Right.
And if you're, like, upset about that, I mean, like, who are you raping?
That's right. That is correct. It's whose team are you on?
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Absolutely. I made a post about, I think tweeted something about, Chris D'Elia. I don't know if you know about his case, but, you know, there's a federal indictment that's being launched against him because you're soliciting sex from underage girls. And these fucking trolls got on me, and they're like, they're going to come and cancel you too. Why don't you cry more? And this and that. And I'm like, fuck you. I'm not out there fucking molesting and raping and fucking soliciting sex from underage boys.
Fear of cancel culture is pretty stupid, because if you're doing the right thing, you're protected. I mean, I don't give a shit if you're religious, because I'm actually not really religious. But like, if you do the right thing, God's protecting you. If you do the right thing, the angels are protecting you.
If
what goes around comes around. If you're a good person and you're doing the right thing and you're good at what you do, you're not going to get canceled.
That's correct.
If you do, it's going to be the biggest injustice in history, and you're going to get crucified, you're gonna be the next Jesus. So fucking enjoy it.
Precisely. 100%. Sammy, you know, I look at someone like you, And I'm like, you know, Sammy's one of the good ones. Like, every time I look at you, I'm like, man, you're a good man. You work hard. You're incredibly talented. You consistently fucking deliver. There's no fucking drama ever attached to you. There's no ever, like, any kind of bullshit attached to you. And that's kudos to you. That's because you're not some fucking freak job out there doing weird fucking shit, man.
Yeah, but and I hope to keep it that way. But, like, you know, I'm going to be honest. Like, there was, like, when I first, like, got on TV and got buzz and, like, Tinder came out, I was trying to have sex, like, multiple times, you know, not multiple times a day, but like a week, I would go out on different dates. And yeah. I realized, you know, my like thing since like day one, since I started like interacting with women, is like, I let them make the first move. And that was always just me being a pussy. It turned out to work out very well for me.
It's called Bumble, Sammy.
Bumble now, you mean?
Well, because Bumble, women make the first move.
Absolutely. But I was, I mean, but I was on Tinder for like, you know, when it first came out, and I was like, I was meeting up, I was like going on multiple dates a week. And I realized at some point, like, if I'm hooking up with a lot of people, like, something could go wrong at some point. Not like I'm going to like do something illegal, but like, if one of the dates just doesn't go well, or I get cocky, like Aziz did, you know, it's going to come back at me. So I see how, you know, dudes especially can get in these situations. And it does ultimately come down to the choices you make and what kind of person you are. But like, there is an alternate reality where if I kept going in that direction, I could have had some Aziz dates, you know?
Sure. I mean, tell me, when you go out, what is it like now for you? I don't know if you're in a relationship or you're dating someone, but what is it like for you now when you go out? Are you more cautious? Are you more careful if you're on dating apps or like going on dates with people? You're just like, let me be cautious. Let me make the... Let the girl take the lead. Like, how is it? Do you walk in with kind of your guards up a little bit, or how is it for you?
I actually have not been dating at all. I haven't been on a date in a long time. Like pandemic, since the really pandemic started. But like, yeah, I mean, in the recent years, like going out, if I went out, it's just I'm still like this, how I've always been, like very reserved. I mean, the Me Too movement, if even, just made me like hyper aware, and like, all that, that'll be my excuse now. Like back in the day, it was just what I did, but now it's just like, no, you got to make the first move. Cause,
I mean, to me, you don't come across as someone who's like threatened by Me Too or Time's Up because you're not a fucking creep job. That's why, you know, and, which is freaking great. So maybe Sammy, you can start like PSAs about how not to be fucking creepy. this is how you do it. You grow your hair out. You don't go for a while and you let the girl make the first move.
Well, you know, I mean, another thing I've learned is that creepy is all relative, because I've been called creepy many times. I've been told I look creepy. Creepy is just feeling like somebody's interested in you when you're not interested in them. That's all it is.
Really? See, that's not what creepy is to me. That's not what creepy is.
Yeah,
if a guy is interested in me and I'm not interested, it's not creepy to me. That's not creepy. What's creepy to me is the fact that the guy is not interested in me just like he actually wants to date me, but he actually wants to do something very sinister, right? Sinister.
Yeah,
I think it's a different definition for a guy than it is for a girl. But for women, the moment we hit puberty, we become very hyper aware of, you know, how guys look at us. Like, they're staring at our chest, they're staring at our asses, and we're just like, what's going on? This is weird. Shit is popping out of my shirt. I don't know what's happening. So I think for us, as girls, we become hyper aware. So we're just like, okay, that guy is looking at me with super fucking creepy eyes, right? It's one thing to be like, hey, I'm interested. I find you attractive. I'd like to go out with you. Versus, I would love to rip your clothes off, put your face down in the fucking pillow, and fuck the shit out of you. Now, that's a different conversation. Lock you in my basement and not feed you for days, right?
I mean, you know, and this is, I'm not justifying this at all, but like, it's guys coming at a first date with 30th date energy.
What's the 30th date energy?
When 30th date is where you've already been with this person for a while, you guys have had sex a bunch of times, you're starting to do it rough.
So wait, is a guy being like aggressive? Sammy, this is a true fucking story, okay? I didn't even give this guy my number because I was getting little creepy vibes from him from a dating app. And we were talking and he was like, yeah, he's like, can you video call me? I'm like, yeah, sure. So I video call because that's now part of my new process. I have to video call you, see that it all works out, and then we can go on, move forward. And I video call him and he's sitting shirtless in his bed and he had his camera turned towards his laptop and he was watching porn. And I'm like, hi, I'm like, are you watching porn in your bed shirtless? I don't need to know what's happening. He's like, well, yeah, you caught me. And I was like, okay, that's fucking creepy to me.
Yeah, right? Yeah. That's funny.
And then he goes, well, I didn't finish. Do you want to watch me finish? And I was like, tempting, but no.
Yeah.
My self-esteem isn't that low. I'm going to go. Okay.
Yeah.
And then I reported him. But it's that shit is fucking creepy as fuck.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of stories like that too. It's really sad.
It's disgusting. Sammy, we're going to wrap up soon because I know you also have to go. Do you have a stand-up special out by any chance?
No, I have albums out. I was going to release – so the last album that I made, it's called Organic, and I was going to release the special associated with it. It's because I did film it. So I was going to release it probably in a month.
Sorry, what is it called?
Organic.
Not organic, Organic?
Organic.
What does that mean?
I know.
Did you just come up with this word?
I did. I mean, I did, yeah.
Organic. All right. That's how do you – it's O-R-J-A-N-I-C. Is that it?
Correct.
Thank you. Spelling bee, brown kids. You know how we do. Three-year first time, first spot winner. Not bragging. Okay, that's cool. I mean, you have albums out on what? On Spotify and iTunes?
Yeah. I have two albums out.
What are they called?
Organic and Get Funny or Die Trying.
Get Funny or Die Trying? Like, Get Rich or Die Trying? Like, 50 Cent?
It's a story, because in it, I tell a story about how I met 50 Cent in the year 2000 before he was big.
Wow. Do you mind sharing that story, or can we?
Well, I was at a concert. It was after a concert, big rap concert. It was like Bone Thugs, E-40, LL Cool J. This was in San Jose, a big stadium.
Wow.
And some friends are outside after, and this guy comes up to us, and he's like, yo, you want my mixtape? We can give it to you for free. And just like, how much can this be worth? He's giving it to us for free. But apparently it was worth 50 Cent. it was 50 Cent. He was handing out his
not half a dollar, 50 Cent.
50 Cent.
50 Cent. Did you give him 50 Cent? Did you Venmo it to him? Or
Venmo didn't exist back then.
Venmo didn't exist back then. That is very true. No PayPal or no Venmo. That is very true. Semi, what are you working on now? I know you have an awesome live online comedy show. I don't know if you're still doing KO comedy.
Yeah, we are. And have you sent us any avails or anything? Do you want to do it sometime?
I would love to do it again. Yeah. I did it once and I would love to do it again. It was a great lineup. Yeah.
Yeah. Just send us your avails whenever you want to do it. But yeah, we do it every weekend. It's called KO Comedy. You can RSVP for free. It's all free shows. Yeah. KOComedy.com. Friday through Sunday. Actually, we have shows throughout the week, but Friday through Sunday are like the main ones.
Yeah. I mean, I just did a show at the Comedy Chateau. Have you been there yet in North Hollywood?
No, I have not.
Okay. Yeah, that's a new... It's interesting. Their location is interesting because it's right across the street from HaHa. And I'm like, okay, that's it. It's kind of becoming like that battle that went down between Laugh Factory and Comedy Store where they were like, you're a Laugh Factory comic. You can't perform at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
So it's kind of becoming a little bit like that. But, man, I'm very excited about all the shows that are coming up. And, Sammy, I know we're going to wrap up soon, but I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Russell Peters and how Russell Peters also helped open doors for Middle Eastern comics, right? And, kind of opened that whole world up. I know that there's a huge thing of comedy that's happening in UAE. There's a big comedy thing happening. I think it's happening in Lebanon too. Big comedy thing happening in Saudi. But again, I think it comes with restrictions. It's the same thing that's happening in India. There's a massive thing. In Pakistan, there's a massive comedy boom that's happening. How? It's different though, right? It's different doing comedy here or in the West versus doing it in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Have you done comedy in the Middle East?
I have. I just did one tour out there. But yeah, I mean, it's different. And like we said earlier, it's new to them. You know, yeah. It's even newer than Indian Americans going to comedy shows, even newer than Lebanese Americans going to. It's like new.
Yeah.
And because of the boom.
Where did you perform?
In Abu Dhabi, the UAE, and Qatar.
Okay. And how was it received? Were they into it? Like, what was their reaction?
Well, I learned a lot. I mean, like, everybody was, like, very nice and on board, but, like, my comedy was not fit. It was not ideal for the audience. Like, it was a tour where I watched other comedians who had experience with those crowds and ripped it, like, murdered it. And I, like, saw, like, the ways they were relating to them in ways that, like, I just wasn't, it wasn't in my set.
Right.
But, you know, that said, I would probably go back differently to it nowadays, but it's also, like, it's a different culture. You have to kind of learn how to position it to them. Like, certain Western references are not going to work. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Why, to me, comedy also sometimes becomes so regional, unless you're doing these kind of global, or you're doing accents or stereotypes like the way
right.
Russell Peters does.
Right.
But like, I feel like Joe Coy has really come up and kind of taken a part of that pie. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, he's got pretty much that whole Asian market, you know, to mm-hmm. himself, which is very big. I mean, Joe Coy really kills that. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I don't see a Middle Eastern comic on that level yet. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, it doesn't exist. First of all, there's comics in the Middle East that I'm not like completely familiar with. So I don't want to speak like in terms of following because I don't know. But from my understanding, Maz Jobrani is your most popular Middle Eastern comedian to date. And Maz is a good friend of mine. Fantastic guy. He's so versatile and he attracts a very diverse crowd. So he can play anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing it. He's definitely doing it. But like, yeah, you know, you don't have your Middle Eastern Richard Pryor.
Right. I think Maz has been on the podcast and he's just so humble and just such a sweetheart.
Yeah. He's a superstar. He is in fact an international superstar. I don't want to take away from because he's the number one. I don't want to take away from him saying like, you know, there is no Middle Eastern Pryor, but it's like he could be a household name, you know?
Right. I feel like also Moss keeps it also very neutral, right? He's not very polarizing. He doesn't really, you know, kind of his comedy is a lot more family oriented.
That's the thing amazing about Moss. He can get families there and he can keep it very friendly, but like he has strong opinions and I've seen him do those jokes and he's smart. He knows when to do it, you know?
Right. Yeah. Know your audience.
Yeah.
Right, Simon? Know your audience. What do you got going on today, man? You got a whole bunch of shows going on after this?
Yeah, I'm doing my happy hour show. And that's about it. I'll have some other shows tomorrow and stuff. But
Got it. And Simon, are you working on creating a project, writing a project for yourself? What are you working on?
Well, I have a couple ideas and I'm just kind of like figuring out which ones I want to push forward. Like, you know, I put really everything on hold. Like I had all these ideas that I was pushing forward on heavily when the pandemic started. And then I was like, just going to go back to the drawing board and start over. And now I have some clarity and I'm like, okay, I'm kind of seeing what's next. And I'm just going to kind of like, buckle down on a few things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Sammy, you know, I look at you and I look at Hasan Minhaj and, you know, you guys are pretty much in the same category. You know, I think with Hasan, I know he talks a great deal about being Muslim and growing up in a Muslim family. And, you know, so that kind of puts him in a little bit more niche than you do. Now, you didn't grow up Muslim, right? Your family's Christian?
Yeah, but like we're not religious. Like my parents were just very a-religious.
Yeah.
But we have Muslims and Christians in our family.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got the full religious experience via them, but like my parents, we didn't have, like my grandma made me go to church a few times with her, and I did have to get baptized for my grandparents. But other than that, just like very just open friends of every religion and, you know, learning from them. But other than that, no religion myself.
Man, you know, I look at Christian families, whether they'd be American or Middle Eastern. Yeah. And I feel like Christian families are chill. As someone who grew up in a conservative Muslim household, we have zero fucking chill, dude. Zero chill, okay? You guys chilling. We zero fucking chill. So right. I feel like, do you feel like, how should I phrase this? Do you feel like having that edge of religion kind of gives Hassan that extra edge to be like, hey, I'm Muslim. I play up the Muslim part. So people are like, oh, Muslim dude, let's hear from his guy. His perspective is so unique. Let's hear what he has to say versus what Sammy Obeid has to say, because Sammy Obeid grew up in a Christian.
Yeah, what if I was just like, yeah, fuck Hassan Minhaj. No, Hassan, like, he hooked me up more than anybody else when I started out comedy. I mean, he taught me a lot of...
Hassan's a very nice guy.
Taught me a lot of very vital things. And so like, and watching Hassan from the very beginning, I was blown away the first time I saw him. I was like, this guy's going to be a legend in the making. And I was actually shocked that he didn't get famous quicker than he did. Yeah. So like, Hassan is a mega talent. And I think that transcends any kind of religion or race. But yes, I do think that because there's not a lot of popular Muslim figures, especially in America, you know, as a Muslim kid growing up, you see that and you're going to gravitate towards it 100%. So, right. And, I mean, and that's a fantastic thing. Like, we need icons like that for brown people, for Muslims. And so, yes, people will gravitate that in a way that, like, I can't pretend that I'm Muslim or go up and like talk about Ramadan, because I don't really know what the fuck I'm talking about. Right. So it would be phony, but like, I do have a lot of Muslim fans. But like, yeah, I can't be an icon for Muslims, because it just wouldn't make sense in that sense.
Right.
But in terms of like why Hassan, you know, is successful as he is, it's 100% his raw natural talent.
Right. Right. Absolutely. No, I've seen Hassan go up. I think Patriot Act was just such a great show, and it really showcased his talent really, really, really well. So
it was brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
brilliant, because he, because I remember they like, I got an opportunity to submit a writing packet for that show, and I completely missed the mark, because I assumed like screens, no audience, just like your green screen kind of thing. And then when it came out and he was in front of a room, I was like, this is fucking brilliant, because now he can use that stand up energy for the show. And, it was a very, very, very great move, great medium for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Sammy Obeid, this has been a pleasure, my friend. This has been a lot of fun. Where can people follow you? We know TikTok is gone, but we got Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. What else? You know, where can they follow you?
Yeah, you can follow me at Sammy Obeid, Twitter, Insta, TikTok no more, but we'll see. Maybe I'll start a new one. And YouTube, Sammy Obeid. You can get from all the socials. You can come see the free virtual shows, kocomedy.com.
Yeah. And maybe we can start a TikTok for you called Obeid Sammy.
Shake Mona, Mona Shake.
That's what I do on Facebook. That's what I do, is Shake Mona, and then Mona Shake is my regular fan page or whatever.
Gotta switch it up.
That's what I do. Sammy Obeid, this was a lot of fun, my friend. James said, thanks, Mona and Sammy. Fun chat. Thank you very much.
Thanks, James. Thank you so much.
Sammy, stay safe out there. I'll send you my avails. I'll just Instagram it to you?
The email that we use to communicate about the show.
Got it.
KOComedyShows@gmail.com.
You got it. Sammy Obeid, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mona. See ya.
Take care. That was the lovely Sammy Obeid. I know you guys enjoyed the conversation, because damn it, I did. And it was awesome, because Sammy's wonderful. If you have not subscribed to my YouTube channel, please do. You can go to youtube.com/ Mona Shake Comedian. Same name on TikTok and same name on Facebook. You can also follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Mona's Comedy. I will see you soon with another brand new guest. Have a lovely evening.